accession number 30416, Mr. John Taylor, Reel 5. Now, after you'd been at Harrogate, you go to the AFU at Milham in Cumbria from June 43 to July 43. Now, the AFU is your what? Advanced Flying Unit?
Advanced Flying Unit, although that's really a misnomer. It was really another one of their ways of finding things for us to do while we were waiting for the next course.
So we were not doing much there either?
We were flying. It was fun.
What were you flying? What were you actually doing?
We were flying Tiger Moths. And we'd got...
learning to fly? Or
no.
No.
The excuse was that we were supposed to be map reading. But we used to go up several Tiger Moths at a time. Again, with fairly young pilots. And a lot of the time we were playing tag around the hills of the Lake District. You know, you go swoop over around the corner down one lake, then another one would come over the top, and that was the first time I'd ever looped the loop in an aircraft. And also got hands-on with the Tiger Moth, you know, in the air. It's, do you want to go? So I had to go. And
did that make you regret? Did you ever think of converting to being a pilot, or were you set on being a navigator?
Set on being a navigator,
now,
I think.
Why didn't you fancy being a pilot?
Well, I think I told you that I didn't think my coordination. Who's that?
No, what I meant was, I mean, did you not increase from having actually had a go in this? Did you not fancy it a bit more, the flying?
Not really. Not really. At that time, I hadn't got a lot of confidence in myself. You know, having gone through school as SWAT, good at lessons but not good at games, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence in what you can achieve yourself.
And that hadn't changed then?
Well, it did later. It did later.
Now, anything else at Milham? I mean, you were only there a month from looks of it.
Yes, I was interested in the fact that the SE Rescue, they had flat-bottom craft with big aeroplane propellers at the back, because the waters there were so shallow that they had to skim over the top. And also discovered the British restaurants there, where you could get a flap-up meal for 5 shillings.
Now, what were the British restaurants? People have mentioned them before. They're not well known now. What was the system?
It was a system when because of the rationing and everything, it was to provide meals at very low cost. I don't know whether they were subsidised by the government or something, but there was a link, official link. But they had a ceiling on the cost of the meal of 5 shillings, which is quite a bit of money, but... Actually, when I got married in 1945, I was only allowed 5 shillings a head for the wedding breakfast.
And what sort of food was it? Was it just normal British food? Or
yes, it was meat and 2 veg sort of thing, and a pudding.
Anything else about Milham?
No, nothing that really strikes.
Now, you're there till July, and then you seem to go to... number 14, Operational Training Unit in Market Harbour. Or you go there in August.
Yes.
And you're there till November. Now, what happened when you got there? What's the first thing that happened? If you want to explain the purpose of an operational training unit, that might help us.
Well, this is where you first crew up and learn to cooperate with pilots and wireless operators instead of just being on a course with all navigators. And we were in Nissen huts. We slept in Nissen huts. But very early on, when we got there, we were taken into a big hangar, and there were all pilots, wireless operators, people milling around, and we were told to pick our own crew. We knew nothing about these people at all. But I was approached by a little Australian, air gunner. He was about 5'2" and nearly as wide. And the Australian blue, with quite a lanky Irishman in tow, pale face, thin features. And he said, "I'm Clem Dowie, but they call me Butch. And this is Paddy Anderson. Do you want to join us?"
Now, Paddy Anderson, or John Anderson, he was the wireless operator.
That's right, yes, yes. And so we three went round, and I think Butch had been talking to somebody else before, because he came back in tow with this flying officer, New Zealand flying officer. Very light coloured hair and a pale face. Very quiet. And he said, "Do you want to join us three?" And John looked at us and decided yes, this is what he'd do. And he said, "By the way, my name's John Mowat." And I said, "I'm John Taylor." And he said, "Well, if we can't have two Johns in the crew, you'd better call me Jack." I thought that was very nice, an officer giving up his name in favour of a sergeant. But he was that sort of guy. And then we encountered another pilot officer who was a Yorkshireman, Dave Eggleston, and he was the bomb aimer. And so that completed our crew, except for the gunners at that time.
So the pilot was Jack Mowat, or John Mowat.
Yes.
Air gunner was Sergeant Clem Dowie. I presume. Sergeant.
Yes, Clem Dowie. Yes.
The wireless operator was another sergeant, John Anderson.
Yes.
And the bomb aimer, Dave Eggleston.
Yes.
Now, you didn't get the engineer at that time, did you?
No, he came later.
Or the mid-upper gunner?
No. No. Just the rear gunner.
Now, how did you blend together, you lot? I mean, as a crew, how did you start to get to know each other?
Well, one of the things that helped was because we had a gunner before. No, we had a mid upper gunner. That's right. And
now, was this Alf Higham, or is this a different one?
This is a different one. This is Frank Dring. We had a gunner before that, but he went all through and went on leave back to Ireland. Dublin, lived in Dublin, never came back. Then we got Frank Dring, who was an ex-car salesman. And the best thing about him was that he sold me a car, a Hillman Minx.
How did you all get on, you know?
We got on very well indeed. We were so different. And because I lived in Nottingham, and because I'd got this car, whenever we were on stand down, or the weather was too bad for flying, or something like that, I used to take most of the crew home to Nottingham. And my mother was extremely good. She got mattresses out, because of course we're furniture dealers, mattresses on the floors, and the crew all stayed, and we all went down to the local pub with my mother and father, and entertained them by singing risque songs with the words cleaned up a little bit. But they liked the fact that they'd got sort of a local lad and his aircrew pals, and so we got plenty of free beer. And of course I got a sister. Well, I'd got two sisters, but the one that was most attractive to the boys. In fact, I used to tell people I took home, "Now, you're going to be attracted to my sister, and you're going to want to go out with her, and then sooner or later she's going to ditch you for somebody else, and then you'll fall out with me. And so don't." But they never took my advice, and they always did. and I lost a lot of friends that way. But
now, how did you start? I mean, you presumably started to fly with them. Now, what aeroplane were you flying at that stage? It was 14 OTU.
We were flying Wellingtons, Wimpies, 1Cs. We used to call them PE aircraft because they flapped their wings above their, you know, hands above their head. But they were very comfortable to fly.
What did you think of the Wellington? Can you describe what it was like to fly and what where everybody was in the crew and what in particular where you were, of course?
Well, I was just behind the pilot again, at right angles to the line of flight with the wireless op on my left. And it was geodetic construction. That meant it was a sort of metal fuselage, like a diamond frame, very stable, very, very strong. And flying characteristics were good. And we did a whole series then. Every day you went up for a flight test.
What's a flight test?
Go circuits and bumps, landing, taking off. Well, the pilot looked at all the dials and things. Sure whether we got an engineer then or whether it came at the next stage.
But I think usually it's the next stage.
It's
Frank Dring, I should have asked. Is it D-R-I-N-G? Or
yes.
Norman Lum would be your engineer. I mean, should we talk about him now? Anyway, what was Norman Lum like? Was he another sergeant?
Yes, a Yorkshireman. Very phlegmatic. Dour. Not nearly as volatile as Butch or Paddy, but he fitted in well. But he usually went home to Yorkshire when the New Zealanders and Canadians and people came back with me to Nottingham, and so did the Irish lad, because you'd get to me for even a night out with a car, because we're only 40 miles away.
Now, so how did it go? So, firstly, you've got circuits and bumps. So really the pilot has been
trained there.
So how did it progress over the next couple of months?
Then we started doing these cross countries.
And what were they like with the whole crew? What was everyone doing?
Well, the bomb aimer was lying down in the bomb bay, map reading and giving me pinpoints. The wireless operator was busy listening in and working the loop aerial too. I also had to practice using the bubble sectants, stand in the little astro dome and try and take sights for what they were worth. And we progressed from daytime to night flights and flying in cloud. So
how did you find the night flights? Was that the first time you'd done night flights?
Yes, it wasn't all that different from me, because I was sitting in a little curtained off space anyway, and I was still doing dead reckoning with information fed from the outside. It was more different for the pilot, of course. And it was there that we had our first, not our crash, but one of our people crashed into one of the hills. And we had to have a funeral parade where we all best blue and marched to the cemetery and fired rifles over the grave. And quite a reminder that flying could be dangerous, and we weren't even on ops. And another thing we did from OTU, our first operation, if it could be called that, because they were going to do a big raid over Germany, and they wanted a diversion to make the German defences think the attack was going to come somewhere else. So they got every crew that could possibly fly from the OTUs, and we all headed out towards Holland. And at the very last minute, as we reached the coast, we all turned around and came back, and hoped by that time the German would have concentrated their defences in that area and let the main force get through. I think it ought to be counted as an op, because if it had have been, I would have got the aircrew star instead of the France and Germany star, because it had to be so many months before D-Day to get that.
Anything happened on that diversionary operation, or was it?
No, it was just...
You weren't attacked or anti-aircraft fighting?
No.
Anything else while you were there? You were there, two or three months.
No, I can't think so. We just got better and better with our flying and drinking. And one thing I do remember, it was only told me by Dave Eggleston, because, of course, he and Jack were in the officer's mess, and I was in the sergeant's mess. The group captain was Group Captain Bonham Carter, and he was a bit deaf, and he had a hearing aid, old-fashioned hearing aid, in his pocket. There was a little hole cut out of the middle of his breast pocket. And Dave said on mess night, some of the other guys, they'd start talking in lower and lower tones until they were practically whispering. And Groupie would say, "Just hold on a minute," and he'd change his battery. And as soon as he changes it, they'd all start talking normally again. He'd say, "Oh, that's better." But that might be apocryphal, but I don't know. We did fly with him once, because he tried to get a trip with all his crews.
What was he like?
Quite brusque. And of course, we, the flight of sergeants, we were a bit in awe of the group captain, the CO. He had more to do with the pilot, I think, than me. But that's about what stands out.
And you were there till November 43, and then you seemed to go to 1654 conversion unit at Wigsley. Now, I'm not sure where Wigsley is, but you were there from November to January. Now, what is 1654 conversion unit, and where is Wigsley?
Well, Wigsley again is in Lincolnshire. All these places are in Lincolnshire, because it's a nice flat county dotted with airfields and things. It's either, could be just verging into Leicestershire, I'm not sure. Anyways, it was still within easy reach of Nottingham for all our nights out. And we're on Stirlings. The idea was, pilots had been flying two engine aircraft. Now they're going to fly four engine aircraft. The Stirling was a really Rolls Royce of aircraft. Except from the flying point of view. It was, all the control levers and knobs were all brightly enameled in different colours. And it could almost be carpeted. I mean, everything was top-class quality. But the only trouble with the Stirling was that it couldn't get above 12,000 feet, which was just the... mid-height flak for flak. So you were very vulnerable. And they'd taken them off ops by that time and using them for conversion.
So this is to get you used to a four-engine aircraft, which would be the Lancaster.
Yes,
eventually.
Yes, eventually.
But the Stirling's characteristics, although not as good, were the same.
Well, you got four engines to look after, and the engineer had all these problems of balancing the fuel from one wing to another and keeping the throttle synchronized and all that kind of thing, and the pilot had the same thing. And of course they started giving him practice on flying on one engine and different technical things like that. I think I was also introduced to the gyro compass as well.
Now tell me about that. You may not be able to explain how it works, but what was good or new about it?
Well, the principle of a gyroscope is that once it's spinning at a certain speed, it doesn't topple over. And so you could set it for a certain course, and whatever happened to the aircraft, if it tilted or anything, it wouldn't topple. If your compasses went, you've got the gyro compass, you could reset your compasses by this gyro compass. And so it was a standby.
Anything else new you were introduced to?
Yes, we had a gadget above my navigator's table that projected star lines onto my chart underneath. And so you could take bearings of the stars and then read it off on these lines on your chart to get your position.
Now, what was this thing called? I've not heard of this at all.
You haven't?
What it was called?
Whether it was called an astroprojector or something like that.
I think they'll probably gather from that what you mean.
Yes.
And was this, did this work? Was it a good, you know, a useful tool?
Not really, because I only ever used the bubble sextant on practice. Never actually used it for real.
Now, what about, were you introduced to any of the wireless beam things that, there were, that they started to use by then? I've forgotten the name of them.
Yes, G, of course, was the thing that
That's
we were...
GEE, isn't it?
GEE, yes.
Now, were you introduced to that there, or had you known that before?
I think it was possibly there at Wigsley.
Now, what was the G navigation? It's a navigation system, isn't it?
Yes, it was very good. We had to re-swear the Official Secrets Act, and they told us how hush-hush it was, and however ever we got shut down when we were on operations, first thing we must do is explode the G-set. It was really like an oscilloscope, or if you think of a little TV set with a round screen. And it had two bars across of light on this screen. There were three stations in England broadcasting signals, and they made a big triangle of the country. And if you imagine that the stations, one say was broadcasting red lines, red radiating lines, and one green and one yellow or blue or something. You could pick out the two strongest, and they showed up as a little blip on one of the lines on your G screen, and the other one there's a blip on the lower line. And you could move by twisting the knobs until these were lined up, and then you could read off along the grid, and it gave you a number, and you looked at the number of these lines on your chart, these coloured lines on your chart, and where those two lines crossed was your position. Very accurate, within a mile, which was very good in those days.
And this, how far would this, was this only use, where was this useful, only over Britain or?
Well, later on, when we went on ops, it got jammed soon after crossing the enemy coast.
What about H2S? Did you have that, or was that somebody else's department, or did you not have it?
We didn't have it.
Were there any other beam or navigation systems you were aware of?
I think there was Rebecca, but I didn't have much to do with that. It was something the wireless op and the pilot worked, where you could latch onto a beam and you got on one side of it, you got dots, on the other side of it, you got dashes or something. But
that was no, you knew much.
That was
now, anything else you were doing at Wigsley?
I did bomb aiming, but not with real bombs.
Just so that in case the bomb aimer was killed, or
yes.
What were the principles of bomb aiming then?
Well, they had a tower with a big map of the countryside underneath, And we lay on a platform above this with a bomb sight, and you could direct whoever was controlling this whole setup by saying left, left, steady, steady, and track your target down the bomb sight and press the bomb tit at the right time. And so at least you got to know something of the principle. And of course, we showed each other in the crew how different things and where they worked and how you turned a knob, and then it went right across, selecting all the bombs on the bomb site, ready to go.
Any other training or special?
No, nothing I remember.
You had another Christmas there, I would imagine. Well, at Christmas at week.
Yes. Yes, we did. I think we had, you know, the usual Christmas where the officers waited on us. And then I think we shot off to Nottingham and had another Christmas back home.
So what next then? In January, you go to...
Syston, was it?
Yes, that's number five. It looks like LFS. Now, I don't know what that means.
Lancaster Flying School.
Is it five or six? It's not clear in the thing. Do you remember? I think it's five. We looked it up and it is five.
Yes.
Now, what were you, obviously you were learning to fly the Lancaster there. Well, fly.
Yes.
So, tell me about what happened at number five Lancaster Flying School in Syston.
Well, the big thing about it, of course, it was only 14 miles from Nottingham. So it was even easier to get home with the crew. And by that time, a pilot had joined us quite a lot as well, and Dave. So there was no class distinction on our crew. We're all Dave and Jack.
So even the officers?
Even the officers, yes.
So you were on first name terms?
Yes, although we called him Skipper when we're in the air. But on the ground it was Jack and John, and he came home with me and was quite happy to go down to the pub with us and everything. Dave was even more gregarious and used to go out drinking with Paddy and Butch. Dave's father was Master Cutler at Sheffield, and Dave took us to the Master Cutler's ball one time it was on.
This is Dave Eggleston.
Dave Eggleston, yes, when his father was his year as Master Cutler. And went in my car, and we always set out, never knowing whether you get enough petrol to come back. We got aircrew petrol, so many gallons, coupons, when petrol, of course, was so severely rationed, only for the doctors and special people got it. So the technique was to call at a garage, plead the story that you're flying and all the rest of it, and ask if they could give you half a gallon. And very often they did. But I think this time we ran out, but we'd always got this can in the back and a tube, because when we really got low, I think Butch, being an Aussie, would creep into the MT section and milk one of the lorries there. And so we got to Sheffield. And after the ball was over, we were invited for a drink with some of these other businessmen. And it was in a bombed building that belonged to one of them. And the basement had been converted into a kind of speakeasy. They got trestle tables full of barrels of beer and stuff. And so we had a high time there before we drove back to Syston.